Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Welcome to All Exits Closed. My name is Cynthia Poehler, and I'm going to be talking with Steve Greenfield. And Steve is going to talk about income sharing agreements, which is kind of like a new layer to the student loan debt crisis. So, Steve, what's going on now?
Okay. Learning about this kind of caught me by surprise. It came up in the course of just searching ordinary news, because apparently it's finally becoming a significant enough piece of the overall financial industry to make the Bloomberg News website. That's how it came my way. And I was greatly shocked and disturbed to read about it, especially how casually the reporter at Bloomberg wrote about, you know, how they operate, why they operate, why people are interested in seeking out this kind of financing, and most particularly why Wall Street is interested in offering it. You know, it's kind of apparently it's been off the radar, because until very recently it was used only for people who were attending, you know, non-accredited educational programs, like online programs and career training and things that aren't part of the accreditation process. But starting about 2 years ago, because of the mounting student debt crisis, it is starting to be offered by, you know, regular mainstream accredited colleges, frequently in conjunction with the colleges themselves providing financing or facilitating with some of their wealthy alumni to provide the financing. And the way that that's managed is that they are hiring brokers who do the investigation of a prospective student for them and make a recommendation both about the viability of putting the prospective student under this type of contract, and as well as establishing a hierarchical scale of interest rates, payment rates, I should say, because they're not really interest rates. It's not a loan. It's a percentage of income that's earned. And creating this hierarchical system of payment rates that are literally based on what you're majoring in. So that if they consider you to be majoring in, you know, something that seems like it points its way towards higher incomes, like computer science or engineering, you're only going to pay about 2.7% a year out of your annual income. But if you're doing something they project as having less earning potential over time, like English, you're going to be paying, you know, 4.5%, maybe 5% of your annual income, which is really, a messed up situation in more ways than we might be able to go through, you know, in the time we have here on the phone. The billing based on the percentage of your income is not based on whether you're working in the field that you studied in, and it is also only suspended when you're earning less than $20,000 per year. So if you're making $20,000 and 1 cent and you majored in English, which requires a 4.5% billing on your annual income back to the person who financed you, you know, you're going to be cut down basically to starvation level, just because you're working, at a low wage job while you're trying to find something in your field or while you're trying to find something that pays better. So what we've got here is a fascinating system by which somebody becomes indebted directly to a person, to another person who has spare investment capital, basically, you know, in layman's terms, who just has too much money and not able to get, you know, high interest at a savings account and looking for new ways to invest it at interest. And so what they're doing now is finding a way to basically tether an individual person's future employment earnings as an investable financial instrument for people with surplus net worth. This is a truly frightening development because, as I said, the payments are a function of your earnings. It's not a debt that you can pay off at a fixed rate. It makes the problem of not being able to buy anything as you're aging out of your college years, because you're carrying debt and not being able to get a mortgage or a car or get married or any of those things, even worse, because you're paying, the more money you make, the more they bill you, the more you pay to the person who invested in you, or the institution, the financial institution that invested in you. So the more you earn, the more gets deducted, and you don't get any closer. Unlike someone who's paying a fixed, you know, say $150, $200 a month, you know, if your income doubles, now you may have the money you need to go finance a car or finance a house or finance a marriage. But in this scenario, if your income doubles, so do your payments. You know, this is like a roll of the dice that the investor is making with your income. And, you know, so that's what it's doing on the personal level. From an economic level, it's creating a group of people who are debtors, but their debt is not on the books anywhere because there's no actual tangible debt. You know, I didn't take a loan from you. I didn't take a loan from you, deposit it in my bank, and then write a check to my college. You're paying my bills directly, you know, as they come in. And in exchange for that, I am now, you know, indebted to you, a form of indentured servitude, because I'm paying you directly. And there's no way for, you know, a commerce investigator or an economist to measure the effect of that debt on our economy and the risk that it's exposing our economy to, the way that we do with conventional debt, because there's no amount on the books. There's no way to know what's being paid off, how much. It's a floating rate depending on what you earn. It is a form, in short, of serfdom. You know, you're being granted access to capital. Back in the days of actual structural serfdom and feudalism, you were being granted access to a piece of land owned by a nobleman, and you farmed it, and you gave him 10% of your crops, right? That he would sell, and everybody who came on the land. And, you know, the way that worked is that since the land was entirely owned by the nobility, they had the power of exclusion, of access to being productive to everyone else in the economy, and they would trade access to productivity in exchange for a fixed percentage of what you produce. This is a financial form of that, once again, right? You need to access higher education so that you can have the career you're interested in, or higher earnings that a college degree would potentially give you. And you're being granted access to that by somebody who has more money than they need, you know, more money than they need for anything, and are looking for ways to turn that money into a revenue generator for themselves. And so this is a form of serfdom. It is becoming increasingly appealing to, you know, students because of the default question, right? This is a form of debt you can go into without any risk of default. We've been talking in previous interviews about what default actually represents in someone's life, right? A loss of access to credit for many, many years, you know, possibly for their entire lives, because they have defaulted on an existing loan and are considered likely to default again in the future, and so they can no longer get credit. Like their life is pretty much, their financial life is pretty much over once they've defaulted. And so this is very tantalizing, because you don't end up with a loan default on your record if you lose your job and can't pay. You're just temporarily suspended from having to make the payments, and then as you start working, you make the payments again. So you don't end up with that blot on your record when, you know, should you face a time of financial insecurity. There are, as you know, we've been discussing, some really major problems with this. One of the major problems is the brokering system, right? The first thing that has to happen is that a broker working for the college that you'd like to attend has to rate you as a potential high income earner when you graduate, but maybe not a higher, you know. You know, how do you answer that question? Well, yeah, I might become a waiter or a taxi driver while I'm writing my play. Okay, no financing for you. You know, okay, I want to be an English major. Okay, well, we'll finance you, but you're going to have to pay you know, double the interest that we would be charging you if you were going to major in a technical field like computer science. And so then that becomes, again, a powerful disincentive for people to explore the range of educational opportunities, the range of careers. I mean, we do actually need English majors in this country, right? Every public school, every high school has an English department and English teachers. Every college, like, you know, kids have to learn how to read. We need English majors. And here we are telling people that, you know, going to college, financing your college will cost you double if you want to major in English than it will if you want to major in computer science. What does that do? That encourages more and more people to go into computer science until such time as there's an enormous surplus of computer science trained people, which suppresses wages in technical fields. More and more people scrounging for work. You know, it's a mess. And, you know, this is kind of, you know, either the beauty or the evil of capitalism, depending on your personal perspective when you're looking at this, right? Capitalism is about finding ways to generate revenue. It's not necessarily about finding ways to invent, you know, a great product that everyone's going to want. It has invented great products based on the profit motive, but it also created, you know, the 2008 financial collapse. It created the Great Depression. It created, you know, unmitigated disasters that starved millions of people to death and started world wars. You know, because what it's really doing is creating revenue streams in excess of what it costs to generate them. You know, that's what profit is. And so if you're in the financial industry, you know, as opposed to, you know, oil drilling or, you know, car manufacturing, if the financial industry is what you're in, when you go to your desk every day, your job is to create new products that your financial institution can offer to the public in exchange for, you know, a steady revenue stream that's in excess of what it costs to offer them that financial product. So here is a problem, right, that we've been talking about. Massive debt. Further complicated by federal law, thanks to Joe Biden and his friends, that make it impossible to discharge that debt even when certified by a court to be in personal bankruptcy. And so now the idea, because of the publicity, the size of the debt, you know, the risk of default and all those other things put together, we have young people and their parents, you know, in their senior year of high school, that are looking at that and wondering if they can go to college at all. And then suddenly to the rescue comes a brilliant new investment instrument, a financial instrument from people of high net worth, of people of, you know, significant surplus cash reserves who are now able to reach people who are, you know, under those fears, uncertain about whether they want to take on actual bank debt and bring on the risk of default and a lifetime of no credit if that were to happen. And so they're tempting them with this. And you know, the articles that are talking about it are agreeing that it's extremely, extremely tempting, you know, on these bases. And people are doing it more and more. And it's one of those things, again, that has happened so many times, where we just go launching off into a new system without anyone running the math down, you know, in advance and trying to figure out whether this is a good idea. You know, we found out the hard way when the Great Depression began that there actually needs to be a certain amount of cash that banks hold on to in case they can't collect their debt so that they don't go bankrupt, right? That amount was measured. And we passed some laws during Franklin Roosevelt's administration requiring that banks not only maintain those cash reserves, but also buy federal deposit insurance so that if something goes wrong, that that the people who have deposits with them can get their money back. And that was also something that helped keep banks solvent, because it made people not feel like they would need to have a run on the bank if they heard that the bank was in financial trouble, because they knew that the insurance would return them the full amount of their deposits. And so that ended up strengthening banking as well, because it ended, you know, something that had previously been common, the run on the bank, right? That leaves the bank completely out of money and closed for business. back in 1998, Bill Clinton and the Democrats and Republicans working together, you know, ended the Glass-Steagall Act and ended those reserves. And by 2008, we were living through it all over again. We are about to launch. We are, you know, obviously we're in the midst. I can't say about to, because it's already underway. We are now launching into a new financial instrument that's being offered as a debt-free way. I mean, boy, talk about bait, right? A debt-free way to finance your college without going into, like, you know, costing that out into the future and seeing what that really means. And by the time it starts falling apart, and by the time people start realizing when they're in their late 20s that they are actually serfs, that no matter how much money they make, they can't get ahead because every dollar extra that they make over what they were making the year before is going to be billed back by the person they're in debt to at a higher amount than they've been paying when they were making less money. By that time, you're going to have, you know, a major, you know, financial revenue generating institution with lots of employees and lots of actuaries and lots of investors. And it's going to be the stock in these companies is going to be part of public employee pension funds and all kinds of things that happen as investments grow, thereby making it pretty much impossible for regulators to do anything about it once it starts being understood what happened. You know, this needs to be nipped in the bud. It probably can't be nipped in the bud from a regulatory perspective right now, just because of the political situation. Banking is not something that either Republicans or Democrats are terrifically interested in regulating at this juncture. It hasn't been since 1992. But at the very least, if we could start getting word out to high school students, to parents, you know, letting them know what a terrible burden they'd be under personally. I mean, the very notion that you're, you know, in personal direct debt to a person who's going to raise the payments that you make to them every time you get a raise, that you agreed to that in advance, and that you're now trapped in this contract is, you know, a really, really important thing that needs to get out, you know, to talk to high school guidance counselors so that they know what to tell parents. You know, I don't really know, you know, this is just you and me here on this podcast,
right?
But we're on the ground floor here, right? We're the people who just noticed this, and we're already involved in conversations with people about college debt. And so, I think that, you know, the college debt thing is an ongoing problem that has quite a few people, discussing it in the media, discussing it in politics, and this is something that's not established yet that could possibly still be stopped before its terrible impact is fully realized. And, you know, we should do everything we can within the college financing community, within people who are running for office right now, and they're paying lip service to student debt relief and tuition-free public college and things like that they're talking about, to put this issue on their radar before it becomes so institutionalized that there becomes a powerful lobbying industry behind preventing it from becoming regulated or ended.
Okay, let me ask you a couple of questions. You know, I understand the concept of serfdom, where, you know, the serfs would give a certain amount of their stuff to the landowner. And now, with this is kind of like the same concept. Would students be indebted to these people forever, or is there a point where the people say, okay, you've done enough, you're free and clear now?
Right. Well, you know, for the moment, the ones that I'm reading about being offered are on a time scale. They seem to be at Purdue, the one college that's really stepped up its offering of this program to its own students. They're offering it for a 10-year period. But, you know, these are things that are also going to be negotiated individually for individual students as the brokering process continues to grow, because it's going to be spoken about to people. You know, so just like mortgages, right? You can get a 15-year mortgage, a 20-year mortgage, a 25-year, a 30-year. You know, people are going to be offered options like this. They're going to be saying, okay, well, we're going to want 4.6% if it's going to be a 10-year repayment plan. But we're going to, we can lower that rate to 4.1% if you take it on for 15 years. It's going to be offered individually to individual applicants the same way that mortgages are, with differing lengths of repayment. But the thing is that it's actually not a fixed 10 years, because let's say your income falls below $20,000 a year for a couple of years, your 10 years just became 12 years. It's an amount of time in which you are working, not an amount of time in which you exist. Any financial interruptions, however long they go on, only extend the repayment period. It's already somewhat of a floating ending date, even though they're being offered with a fixed ending date. And no doubt that when differing interest rates based on differing lengths of repayment are brought in, that's going to still be part of it. So if you took a 20-year, you could potentially be, paying back for 30 years. That's why it's important to recognize what this is and get it in front of political, policymakers as quickly as possible, so that it is not as complicated as it will become if it's left to go on.
So my other question to you is, wealthy people are giving money to college students for their college, tuition and stuff, and then the college students pay back. Okay, so if I wanted to do that, if I was college age and I wanted to do that, how would I find these benefactors?
Well, for starters, some of them are coming to you. They're being offered through the financial aid offices of colleges themselves. This one company that is, vetting potential students under contract to colleges that I've been, reading about, which is the most prominent company at the moment. Let me just grab here. They're called Vemo Education, V-E-M-O. And so they're actually working under contract with colleges, and they're expanding at the moment, into more and more colleges. They got themselves on the map by signing a deal with Purdue. And then the shocking thing about that is that that's a public college. Several of the colleges that they're under contract with are public colleges, which, as we've been talking about, really shouldn't be, foisting that kind of expense in the first place on people that want to go there. So they're reaching out directly through financial aid offices at colleges to make this known to applicants that they can do this. But they're also, seeking to work one-on-one with individuals coming to them. So I don't really know, how they're going to keep expanding their business model. At the moment, they say, we partner directly with colleges, universities, and other educational providers to design, implement, and maintain income share agreements. So at the moment, it seems like their outreach is to directly contract with educational institutions. But it's going to spread from there. There are going to be people who are going to just become direct financing brokers to students and families.
So in other words, if I wanted to take a major at, let's say, SUNY, then and I'm at the financial aid office, the financial aid office would offer this to me, and I would decide whether or not I want to do it?
Yes.
Okay.
That's exactly how it works.
So how long do you think this has been in existence?
I actually have information on that, both from Vemo itself and from the Bloomberg article, which points out that a version of this was done at Yale in the early 1970s, and it was a disaster. I'll actually read you directly from the Bloomberg Businessweek story. The last big ISA experiment at Yale University in the 1970s ended up as a cautionary tale. Yale pooled all borrowers, and they owed the school a percentage of their incomes for 35 years, or until everyone paid back what they owed. The idea was that graduates who ended up with high-paying jobs in finance would subsidize those who chose public service. But many students defaulted, leaving the remaining borrowers on the hook longer than they'd expected. Other wealthier students exited the pools via large one-time buyout payments. The remaining students tended to be lower incomes. Some stopped paying altogether. Yale ultimately bailed out the borrowers, winding down the whole program in 2001. So Yale was offering this as direct internal financing for close to 30 years. Juan Leon, who sells business jets, graduated from Yale in 1974 through the college's tuition postponement option. That's what Yale was calling it at the time. You know, by the late 1990s, he'd paid back $8,000. Anyway, so you know, that was all he had managed to pay back between 1974 and the 1990s. Then said, he commented, we didn't read the fine print. It was quite onerous. And so, like, here's the weird thing, right, is that this particular form of financing has already been explored and collapsed. And that's just the collapse from Yale's perspective, right? That doesn't say anything about the hundreds of people who did it, whose lives were then, you know, seriously negatively impacted by the repayment systems over the course of what, in many cases turned out to be 35 years when they thought it would just be a few years when they got out. And so here it is starting up again, and nothing's being done to stop it from happening. And in fact, as the debt crisis gets more and more press, as people like you and me keep doing this, and it keeps getting more and more press, it's going to come to the attention of high school seniors and their parents more and more that taking on traditional debt for college is a problem. And this is going to be, you know, looked at increasingly as a tantalizing alternative. Again, like I said, because the big thing that it offers is no chance of default, no chance you will have a default on your credit rating. Although, you know, who really knows, right? If you're not paying back, they can certainly get access to the ratings agencies and put you in as somebody, you know, with poor employment prospects. And then, you know, next time you want to rent an apartment, your landlord's going to read that. And, you know, so it's a big, big problem.
Right. Okay. One last question, and then I know you got to get ready for your vacation.
Yeah.
If colleges are offering this from benefactors, how are the colleges benefiting from this? I mean, they're not going to do it out of the goodness of their heart. They've got to get something out of it, right?
Right. Well, they're getting a piece of the action, too. I mean, they're getting but they're also getting something that makes students want to go to their school instead of somebody else's. So it's good for them in terms of attracting, freshmen to come enroll there. Instead of some other school that might require them to take a loan, right? Like, let's say requires me to take a loan, but Vassar across the Hudson River offers me this form of financing, which protects me from loan default. I might choose Vassar over SUNY New Paltz, you know, just because of I like the way that the financing is going to work. So it works for them in terms of encouraging people to enroll at their school. But again, only if they avoid thinking about the long-term consequences.
Okay. So, Steve, you're going on vacation, and we'll talk again in a couple of weeks. But like you said, this is an area that has to be explored more, and people have to know about it. So I'm sure we'll be doing other conversations about this. So you've been listening to Steve Greenfield. This is All Exits Closed. If you like this show, like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. and look at the website, All Exits Closed, www.allexitsclosed.com. Steve, enjoy your vacation, and we'll talk when you come back. Thank you.
Okay.
And thank you, everyone, for listening. Okay. Have a good day. Bye.